to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, 89.1 FM, Story City, Ames, and the surrounding area, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area. My co-host for today is Cornelia Flora. So glad to have you with us, Cornelia.
It is a real pleasure. And I get to introduce our guest, who is one of my very favorite people in Iowa, from Iowa State, and in general, Neil Harrell, who is Emeritus Distinguished Professor of Economics and was for a very long time the initiator and the director of the Center for International Agricultural Finance. And we had connecting buildings at Iowa State, and so there were always all these wonderful people from all over the world coming through because they were working with Neil. So, again, this is such a privilege, but a question I have never asked you but would like to is, how did you get into all this?
Well, it's a long story, and let me jump to about midway through that because that's where it really happened. In life, you have crossroads you reach, and sometimes you don't realize just how important those crossroads are in making decisions. I had one great disappointment in the summer of 1957. I was in the military. I came home to where my parents were living on a farm in southern Iowa to meet with the owner of the farm they were tenanting with the objective of renting it myself. And we spent a half day around the kitchen table discussing, and I could see he was not impressed. This was an MD from California, San Bernardino. His grandfather had been the first owner of that half section of land. And so he, as the second generation down, did not really have a great feel for the farm, except the fact that it produced some revenue. So at the end of the afternoon, he said, Neil, he said, I feel uncomfortable in writing this to you. You have sketched out what you want to do, and I was planning on about 1,000 head of cattle on feed and maybe 3,000 hogs, which today is nothing, but then it was quite a bit. And he said, you have me scared. He said, if you're half successful, I couldn't afford to pay my income tax. And I knew then I had a loser in terms of my effort to try to convince him that I really did want to farm. And I did. I had planned on doing that. So sadly, I hopped in the car and I headed for Minneapolis. My senior year, two of us at Iowa State had been offered positions with General Mills in their executive training program. They were going to send us around 6 months to each part of the company, and it was supposed to be kind of a fast track up. Well, I made the call. They said, fine, we're glad to hear you're back out of the military, and come on up. I stopped in Des Moines. My cousin, who I was always very close to, had been with Wallace's Farmer as a field editor. And he said, you know, something happened today. I resigned from that job, and I'm taking the editorship of another publication in town. And he said, why don't you, if you're not totally sold on General Mills, why don't you check with the editor and see if he'd be willing to take you on for a while? So I gave him a call the next morning, met with him, and he hired me, much to my great surprise. I told him up front, I said, I'm not a journalist. I had one course in journalism, Journalism 225, and I enjoyed it, but I really can't say that I'm a journalist. Well, he said, don't worry about that. We only have two journalists on the staff. The rest of them are animal science and so on. And so I went to work for them. And it was in September of 1957. And in the course of working on articles, I was putting together three articles on what we now call succession planning. And I felt that was a priority that was going to be more important going forward. And so I went as far as I could. And then I heard there was a professor at the University of Iowa Law School who was willing to talk to mere mortals. And so I called up, got an appointment, June 7th, 1958, and drove down there. Got there a little early, and he was a little late. And we talked for a half day, and he gave me cheerfully that much time. And he sketched out what, after he saw I was serious, sketched out a program and said, we're trying to find a guinea pig, someone who's willing to get a law degree and a PhD in economics. That caused me to perk up a little bit. And I said, really? I said, that sounds very interesting. So we talked another couple of hours. And when I walked out of there, having received assurance that I was going to be the one, I could tell this was one of those life-changing events. This was one of those genuine intersections that you come to in life. And he became one of the most important people in my life, John O'Byrne. He's now deceased. He was a Harvard graduate, did not understand agriculture, but he was head of the Agricultural Law Center at the University of Iowa Law School. So I went home and had to tell my wife, and I fully expected her to say, you know, we will have lived 7 years in married student housing, but I was just enjoying our new house on 66th Street in Des Moines. But if you want to go in that direction, I'm very supportive of that. So we packed everything up and our older son, and we started law school that fall. Well, that was the beginning. And since then, I finished the law degree on schedule and then moved to Ames and worked on the PhD and finished it in the late 1964. So that's really how I got involved with all this. But it was the result of a deep disappointment. But it was turned out that it was the right thing to do. And so that's how it all started.
But imagine if that original farmer had done some sort of succession planning where he cared about the farm rather than just seen it as another financial asset.
That's a good question. He eventually died, and I had tried repeatedly to buy the farm after all this happened. And he said, one day I flew out there, and he said, Neil, he said, I just can't sell it to you. I couldn't afford to pay the income tax. And then he revised it. He said, not that I couldn't do it. He said, I don't want to have to pay the income tax. So I said, all right, keep in mind. So when he was getting in his sliding down years, he told his boys, he had four sons, that give Neil a chance to buy that farm. So after his death, and then his wife died, one of the sons called up and said, we're willing to sell the farm. And so I said, well, I might be interested. And I said, what do you think it's worth? So we talked there a little bit about value, and we reached an agreement. And so in the fall of 2002, we agreed to buy the farm, 320 acres, and got possession the following March 1st. So that's kind of the end of the process, except for the fact that we dearly love that that farm and other land we own in Napanoose County. That's where I grew up. I went to one-room country school where I was the only one in my class for all 8 years, and where I learned a lot, contrary to what many think about rural schools. We had to take an exam back then if you're in a rural school to show that you were able to master high school. They didn't ask that of the graduates of eighth grade at the school in the cities, but they did the rural schools. And so I went to Seymour. There I met my wife. She had her name is Harris, and my name is Harl. So she sat in front of me in study hall. And she had been valedictorian of Wayne County, and I was valedictorian of rural schools in Napanoose County. And so this was almost on the county line. One of the interesting things was people were taking bets what's going to happen here between these two people colliding. And so the first 2 years we were pretty much competitors, and then we started dating. And that was another interesting part of this a matter of looking at life through the prism of intersections, another one of those intersections. So it's a long story, but a surprising one. When you think back to where I was in the 1940s, 1950s, I didn't believe for a moment that I would ever be in the situation where I am today. But then a lot of other things have changed too.
So how did you get interested in international? I mean, that is the most incredible story.
Well, I've always had an interest in matters international. And up through the years, I had contacts with a number of places. My major professor, John Timmons, was very active. And Earl Hedy was very active. So I had two mentors in the international field to look to. But it really came to a head in the in 1990. The wall fell on November the 9th, 1989. And before that, President Bush, that's Bush 1, had been to Warsaw and gave an address saying, we know what you're going through here, and we want to be helpful as you transition to a market economy. And we have budget problems, and that'll be a constraint, but we really do want to help you. So he sent over Dole, Mosbacher, and Yeider, three secretaries, in November. And they agreed to send working groups one at a time. Poland was to be kind of the pilot. All the countries had about the same problem, except a few of them had overrun by the Germans, a market economy. But it had been so long that almost everyone had forgotten how market economy functioned. So I was selected to be on the first working group to go and assess what U.S. should be doing in those countries. There were seven of us, and we bounced around Poland in February of 1990, looking at all aspects, but focusing heavily on education, banking, credit, finance, and related areas. I came back convinced that we really needed to be as helpful as we could because their future was going to depend heavily upon whether they were able to master enough to merge their economies sufficiently with the West so that they could trade and understand commerce between the countries. So I was over there in February and came back, had open heart surgery. I knew I had a slight problem before I left, but I didn't do anything about it. I was walking to the library once a week to do my updates. We had to do them in the library then. Now they're electronically provided. But I would feel this little bit of pain in the chest. And I thought, well, it's cold weather. It was in January. I knew better, but I kept telling myself that was the outcome. So I went to Poland and bounced around, as I said, in a State Department van, came back, almost missed my flight connection in JFK in New York. And I had too much luggage, so here I was, moving myself and all my luggage from there to LaGuardia, which is no small task, as some of you know. And so I get back, and the first thing I did was go to the library the next morning. A little bit of pain again. Well, we had an ice storm in central Iowa. This is early March by this time, and they canceled classes. I thought, well, if you have nothing else to do, you better take care of this problem in your chest. So I went downtown to the McFarland Clinic, and their EKG system was down because of electrical failure during the night. But they got it up and running, and the first thing it printed out was abnormal. So I had open heart surgery. I had nothing else to do, so I started raising funds for our first school because I concluded what we really needed to do is to provide an educational program for those people in banking, credit, finance, because they were going to be the lead effort, the advanced party, if you will, in dealing with market economy issues. So we started raising funds and raised about $50,000 while I was convalescing. And we had our first school in July and August, end of July, beginning of August of 1990. And it was so successful. The Duane Register ran a front page Sunday story about it, about how innovative and creative and useful it was. We ended up had 79 of these schools, some here, some abroad. And I think, as I look back, it probably was the most important thing in my life was working with those people in terms of the effect, the impact that had. And I'm trying to be as humble as I can about it, but it really was addressing some very key issues in those countries. And so we still have contacts with those individuals who were here. About 1,600 graduated from our schools. And so that's really how I got involved with that. And as I said, it was one of the very rewarding parts of my entire career. And I've had a number of things that were rewarding, but this one was really special.
Well, you know, one of the important things that you did, unlike what happened when we went in and advised the Soviet Union after it broke up, is that you said, no, this involves a good market economy, involves the state and private sector working together.
Precisely.
And we, in the Soviet Union, we pretended that you didn't need a state. And so you don't have the institutions of finance, et cetera, banking that are necessary.
It really takes a legal system to support the market economy.
Yes.
And they didn't understand that, and they had never really had a market economy. They kept saying, how do you set prices? We don't set prices. You let the market set the prices. Oh, how could it do that? It doesn't have any brains. And they didn't understand the power of a market. And we were very patient as we could be. Finally, the younger people began to get it. There was a difference between those who were in their 50s and those who were in their 30s and 40s. And one of the individuals, one of the members of the first class that came here, he was actually born in Kazakhstan, but he was lucky. He got a good education. He became head of Vashnil, the educational program in the Soviet Union. And he led our first Russian-speaking group the second year we were growing, 1991. And he was in the front row, 160 Hedy Hall, and I started talking about real estate sales, setting value. And he jumped to his feet. He was about 6'6". Mm-hmm. He jumped to his feet. He said, that is immoral, eyes flashing. And I said, what do you mean it's immoral? Why, he said, that's like selling your mother. I would never think of selling my mother. And that's the mother country. And so he sat down, and I eased back a little bit, and I went around the rest of my lecture there, but I tried to get the message across. 3 weeks later at the end of our school, we asked him to evaluate the program. And he was the very first to speak because he was the senior party person. The party was still dominant then. Mm-hmm. This was in May of 1991. And so he got up and he said, well, I said, the first thing we need to do is accelerate pace of economic development. That's obvious. Second thing we need to do is develop a land market.
Uh-huh.
And our faculty were standing around leaning against the wall. And I thought they were going to fall over in a dead faint because they had all heard this interchange the very first day we were lecturing. And then we learned that he and his group had been arguing every night after dinner. Are these wild-eyed economists from Iowa State right? Do we really need this?
Wonderful.
And they concluded, yes. And in fact, he went back, resigned his government job, and became the president, one of the first presidents of a private bank in Moscow. Today, he's so busy when I have a chance to be there that it's difficult to get an appointment with him. But it illustrates he was young enough and willing to consider the possibility that just might be correct for him to accept that.
And you provided, through the school, a space where they could sit and really argue about it and discuss it without any fear of retribution.
But they were reluctant to discuss it with us in public until they had made sure
that they were all
willing. They weren't just being led down a primrose path. So I thought that was all very interesting. And after that, we didn't have nearly as much trouble, at least not with the Russians. And we never did have problems with the people from Eastern Europe other than the Russians. But they were the ones who were so devoted, some of them, to events since 1917, that they just couldn't abide the thought that their government was going to be receding into the background and let the market run their economy. That was one of the very real high points of my career, and I mentioned that lots of times. But it's a long way from Appanoose County, Iowa, to Moscow, and I've thought about that a lot of times. And every time I lifted off from Frankfurt to come home, I would say, sure nice to be going back to where you can at least understand the problems. But my next thought was, but how can we get back here?
Yeah.
Because the needs were so great. You get to the point where, working internationally, where you really begin to wonder, is it best to put your efforts domestically, where we often make vernier kinds of adjustments, or should we grapple with some of the really big issues in the international world? And you have to get a balance. And I was happy that the system let me do that.
Well, I think what is really interesting is you could not imagine when you and your wife were sitting behind each other in the country school what your career would be. You could not have done this had you planned it.
No.
I mean, the point was you were able to say, this is an opportunity.
That's right.
Let's go with it.
I think I've always had a desire to try to get in a position where I could be helpful in a little bit broader sense. But the opportunity just wasn't there. If I had farmed, I don't know what I would be doing today. I may have failed in the 1980s. It's hard to tell. But my background was helpful in many ways. I was raised to work fairly hard. In fact, my father, when I was entering what was then called primary, he told me, look, Neil, if you can pass primary and first grade the 1 year, you'll get a ULAM. That was a lot of economic incentive. So I really worked hard at it. And although I was the only one in my class for the whole 8 years in this one-room country school, I had some very, very good teachers, and they encouraged me to work at my pace. And so by mid-year, I'd usually be through the assigned work, and I could roam through other things. And our teachers would go to the county library and pick up additional reading material. So it was the best of all worlds. You know, it's the old idea of the professor at one end of the log, you at the other end of the log, the Socratic method of looking at education. And there's nothing really, really wrong with that. In fact, I consider myself not to be deprived for having gone to one-room country school, but really the best of all worlds. If you have teachers who are creative, innovative, and will encourage you to produce. So that foundation, I thought back many times, was really very helpful. And I started out in life working. The first task I was assigned, I was just past 3 years of age. It was in winter of 1936-37. My dad assigned me the task of budding and tipping seed corn in a crib. He had a mound of ears from the drought-studded 1936 crop year. And he said, Neil, your job, whether it takes the whole month or not, is...
What does that mean, bud and tip?
Shell off the irregular kernels at the end of the year. Because those don't go through the planter plates very well. And so you have to shell those off. And then he'd run the rest of the year through a canned corn sheller, and that was his seed supply. He was not willing to use hybrid seeds. We today accept hybrid seeds, but not then. Mm-hmm. I can remember him coming through the door saying, grumbling to himself, we can't afford to pay... It was either $3 or $4 a bag for hybrid seed. Corn price is just too low to afford that. But that next year in 37, two of the neighbors got a little bit of seed that was hybrid. Their yields were a little bit better. Their yields were about 60 bushels, ours about 40 bushels. My dad was not dumb, but he was cautious. And the next year, everything was hybrids. But I spent that month of February budding and tipping those ears. I thought that was endless. That was the kind of learning situation that I was in.
See, we've seen sort of two examples of this adoption and diffusion of innovation. Neil's sort of on the what we would call the innovator place, and his dad was sort of in the middle saying, you know, I'm going to see if this works. So you had to have a neighbor try a little bit of it, and then you see it, and then it moves.
Sure.
And that is a marvelous pattern. And what we also see is being that cautious is not necessarily hereditary.
Right. I had taken some sociology, not very much, but Bolin Beal had pioneered that idea, and I found it very interesting. And I could see in my home community examples of that. Mm-hmm. And there were the ones way out here in front who anything new, they were going to grab onto. And the others, doubters, will you show me this is a good deal, and I will possibly pick it up. And that's exactly what happened with my dad. He was he was quite willing when he could see it was a good economic move.
Mm-hmm. Well, this has been a fascinating discussion, and also it really is a great lead-off to what we're going to start trying to do in our Local Talk Wednesdays, and that is we're going to try to do more exploration of the stories of our farming community.
In honor of the international farmers we've been hearing about, Paul Hertz has found a Czech folk song for us, The Farmer Who Went to the Fair.
Šel sedlák na jarmarku vící smotky, a kolko vyklobouk klukovi potky, a srdce puňčoky a děvce kytly, a holce střevíčky přines to v pytli. Thank you. повсіні, п'єте прочесніка, ач п'є свині, вода в хсеварі, зм'єдєнце скаче.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, Story City, Ames, and Surrounding Area. Today, we are focusing on farm life in our surrounding area, starting with two professors emeritus from ISU, my co-host Cornelia Flora and Neil Harrell, to give us a fascinating front row seat on how Iowa State University became involved in teaching the former Soviet republics and even the Russians themselves how to operate in a market economy. We'll continue the story with Susan Lazla, telling us how Iowa House was created to give international visitors a home-like atmosphere for extended visits to Ames. Hello, Susan. Thanks for coming to the studio to tell us the story of Iowa House.
Well, that's always my pleasure. Well, it began very unexpectedly. I was working at Iowa State University with Jim Kissinger, who was the director of a project to assist in the restructure of agriculture and agribusiness in the Czech Republic and Slovakia. I realized in my position there in that program that we really needed different housing for our international guests, mainly because most of what was available was out on the highway. We had good accommodations, but they were too far away because many of them were here for a week or more. They needed to be able to buy their own groceries, store them, cook them, prepare their own meals, in other words. And they needed to be closer to the university. It's very tiring to work in another country where that is not your first language, if indeed it's a language you speak at all. I talked with a number of people at the university, and it was obvious that was not going to happen in the near future. So I decided, really on a whim, to create a special home here close to campus to house these folks. And that's how Iowa House came to be. I bought an old fraternity house, a beautiful building, just half a block from the university, and it was it was built in 1928, and it was the former home of a fraternity, and of course it wasn't quite in the shape that I would want it, and I. So I planned a renovation project, and I told the contractor, wonderful, wonderful contractor at that time, that it had to be finished by October 16th of 1994, because if I remember correctly, I do believe it was one of Neil Harrell's banking schools that was coming. And this was the 1st of June. That put a lot of pressure on these very talented people who were working for this contractor. And on the 15th of October, they pulled all their equipment out. And we were expecting all of these people the next day. Friends, folks I worked with, all came, and we got the house in order. Even the president and two of the vice presidents of the bank came out, and we were until 2 o'clock in the morning getting that house ready, and we made it. Our first guests arrived, and we just acted like we had been doing this for a long time.
Well, could you describe Iowa House a little bit?
That living room and dining area were just lovely, and we served breakfast there every morning, a continental-style breakfast for our international visitors. We ended up with 11 guest rooms. We had 3 on the main floor and 8 on the second floor. The first floor all had private bathrooms. The second floor shared bathrooms. Most Europeans were accustomed to that at the time. I don't think folks today would go for that. But in each room, I did have a small refrigerator, shelves for any food that they wanted to keep, as well as microwave ovens in every room. Of course, that was the best we could do in terms of their cooking. Most of them did not know how to use a microwave, but for the most part, folks picked up on what they could do with a microwave, and they were most appreciative of that. It's difficult to work in a different country with different types of food, and they really needed to store some of the kinds of things that would make them feel at home. I think we met their needs very, very well.
Well, it sounds delightful.
It was. It was a delightful time in my life, greeting and getting to know so many, many wonderful people from all over the world. I still hear from some of them, and that was 15 years ago.
Well, thank you so much, Susan. And that was Susan Laszlo, and we heard from her about the first Iowa house in Ames.
Thank you, Susan.
This is KHOI Community Radio, Story City, Ames, and we have been talking with Neil Harrell about the Center for International Finance, how it got started, and what it accomplished, and with Susan Laszlo telling us about how the visitors who came to the schools that were part of the Center for International Finance were made to feel at home at Iowa House. And now we're going to turn to another organization that started about the same time, also dealt with international people, but was quite different. And this is IRIS, the Iowa Resource for International Service. And with us today is Del Christensen, the Executive Director. Since IRIS is also an international organization, we're welcoming Del Christensen with a Polish folk song from the Beskid Mountains. Hello, Del. Welcome to KHOI.
Thanks, Susan. IRIS was started by a former Lieutenant Governor of Iowa, Bob Anderson, back in 1993. And actually began with a focus on journalists and journalism, primarily journalism that was starting to begin in emerging democracies in Eastern Europe.
So the very same time and the same impetus.
Exactly.
I mean, your expertise, I presume, was in journalism rather than in international finance.
Correct. At the time, Bob Anderson, in addition to being lieutenant governor, had worked as a professor for journalism at the University of Iowa and had also taught journalism at a high school level in Iowa. He had the journalism bug and just connected the international bug to it.
Were you a journalist?
I was not. My focus is actually on the environmental areas and also in the sustainable agricultural areas.
Then this is wonderful for our interests here at KHOI.
We've had so many opportunities to bring over group from throughout the world in the 20-plus years that IRIS has been around. And while it began focusing on journalists, it really evolved into what amazing resources we have here in the state of Iowa that we can share with people around the world and have them benefit from knowledge that began, in many cases, right here in Iowa. So we've had groups that have come in from an agricultural background, groups that have focused on renewable energy, community development, any number of things. And there's always been some fabulous Iowa resources to that. And back in 1993, we had a wonderful group from the Republic of Georgia that was here focusing on dairy production and how to improve their dairy production both production, marketing, and distribution of dairy products. Very early on, when Bob Anderson started IRIS, we made it clear that we wanted to have an exchange program that always included homestays with Iowa families. And there's just nothing more welcoming and more prone to opening up conversation and learning about different cultures than to share that culture, your own culture, and their cultures in your own home.
And they were such a variety of students. You have one on your website about South Africa, and I wondered if you could that seemed to me to be quite pertinent to what we were interested in today. Could you tell a little about that?
I think you're talking about Nathan Schwartz. He was a high school exchange student about 2 years ago now. That came to Iowa, and he was placed over with a host family in a small town in eastern Iowa. And when oftentimes we'll get applications for these students, and we'll learn a little bit more about them when they before they arrive. But one of the things that piqued our interest about Nathan is he was very interested in agriculture and also in FFA. And he became one of the most active FFA members in his school while in Iowa, and has taken that that idea of FFA, which is international now, taken that back to really emphasize what can be done using that model in South Africa.
He came just as an individual student, exchange student. Yeah, I was part later of an exchange with a group of Nigerian students. They were all over this area. There were several in Des Moines. There was one up in Gilbert. And this, I think ours was the only one in Ames. Now, yeah. I want to mention this today because our program on Monday was about Ramadan. We had a student who became quite spectacular in Ames. He was Jamil Jamilu. Now, he was with us in the fall, and Ramadan that year was in the fall, and he was a devout Muslim. Now, this is very interesting because he was just fixated on being a soccer star, and he talked all the time. He could hardly wait till soccer season started. He was into pop music. His mother had a shop in the capital of Nigeria. Mm-hmm. So he was very sophisticated as a teenager, but he was devout. He set his alarm so he would wake at sunrise, and if he was out for the evening, he was nervous when it was time for prayers, yes. That he had to get to a place where he could pray. Well, when Ramadan came, of course, for us, he didn't eat breakfast, he didn't eat dinner, but in the evening, he went to the mosque. The student from Gilbert came down so they could both go to the mosque. And so after school, they'd listen to rock music up in Jamil's room. And then after that, they would go over to their prayers in the mosque, and then they'd have their evening feast over yes. in the mosque. And the mosque is just one block from our house. So it was just a wonderful introduction to what it would be like to be a teenager and a Muslim in Ames during Ramadan.
Yes. Yeah, the that particular program is a U.S. State Department-sponsored program called the Youth Exchange and Study Program. And it focuses in on bringing youth from countries with prominent Muslim populations so that Americans can get a better understanding about that particular religion through the eyes of youth, and so youth from those other countries can get a better understanding about Americans. And this is our, we began that program in 2003 was our first group, so we're moving in on another 13th group that'll be coming in under that program. And yeah, in some ways, they're just like a teenager from anywhere else.
Now, actually, I don't think Ames has ever had a soccer player like Jamil. We went to a game toward the end of the year, and it was amazing to watch him play soccer. And at the end of the game, they carried him off on their shoulders. Yeah. He was such a soccer hero. And that was fun to know him.
Over the years, IRIS has had more than 1,800 participants that have come from other countries to Iowa. And almost half of them have been youth. They leave a remarkable imprint on our host families and on our society here.
You have lots of host families? You need some more?
We always have a need for extra host families. Currently, we've got 30 more high school exchange students that will be coming in from about 17 different countries in August. And they will be placed throughout the state of Iowa. We have a few that are in the central Iowa area, so we'll be looking for possible host families for those students. But also, throughout the year, we have group activities with those 30 students, and oftentimes we have those in central Iowa. So we look for short-term host families that can host for a few days while we have group activities with the folks. So if anybody is interested in hosting a student, they can contact IRIS.
Okay. Well, could you give your address and other contact information? We'll put you on our website.
Yeah, that'd be great. Yeah. Our office is at 600 5th Street, Suite 301, and our phone number is 515-292-7103, or you can email us at info@iris-center.org.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
I hope you get some calls.
Yeah.
Welcome to Tuning Into Agriculture, a new segment on all topics related to agriculture that we plan to air at this time every Wednesday. So if agriculture is your thing or that of someone you know, take a look at the clock and remember, this is the time to tune into agriculture on KHOI Community Radio, 89.1 FM. There have been a lot of topics in the news these past couple weeks concerning agriculture, including controversial EPA regulations about ditches and ethanol fuel standards. But today, we cover a topic that some would say, like the Iowa soil, can't be covered enough. Here with me is Sarah Carlson, an employee of Practical Farmers of Iowa, who specializes in cover crops. Welcome, Sarah.
Thanks for having me.
So in Iowa, the word crops is often synonymous with commodities. Market gardeners may also talk about their crop of spinach or tomatoes. Crops are what farmers harvest for profit or personal consumption, but cover crops have a different purpose. Right, Sarah?
Right. So a cover crop should more be thought of a soil improvement practice instead of something that you would harvest to gain income from or to eat. So it's more of a practice that's a improvement in your soil and your long-term stewardship of the ability to grow crops.
And typical cover crops are?
Sure. So it really depends on your system. If you have a garden or you're planting vegetables, typical cover crops might be warm season plants like sun hemp or sorghum Sudan grass or oats, which would be a cool season plant. You might want to mix in some of the legumes like crimson clover. But if you're growing corn and soybeans, common cover crops and what we'd see on the larger fields around the state of Iowa would be cereal rye or winter wheat or sometimes maybe winter triticale. Those are more the common cover crops that we see on the corn and soybean acres. So if you have a shorter season crop, something that's harvested sometime in July or by early August, and you could plant, you know, into an open field with a drill or with a planter, you can plant any cover crop you want. The choices are limitless. So you could try buckwheat, which is great for soil. You could use, again, more of the clovers. You could work in the radish, the oilseed radish, which is kind of the famous cover crop that we hear a lot about because it does such great things to the soil. It helps reduce compaction. It helps cycle nutrients. It can suppress diseases and nematode problems. And radish is great for that, but it really has to be planted early. So when you have winter wheat or oats or something harvested early, or let's say you weren't able to plant because of flooding in the spring, and so you're prevented from planting, that's when you have a lot of choices on cover crops. The majority of cover crops in Iowa for corn and soybean farmers are planted with airplanes. So they switch over from the sprayer that they would use to spray fungicides or insecticides. The pilots switch over from that wet unit to a dry box, and then they fill that with seed, and that's usually the cereal rye. Only a handful of cover crops really can survive and perform really well in that shady canopy around the Labor Day planting period.
There's just so many variables when it comes to cover crops. It must be very challenging to convince farmers to try something that's so different and out of the norm and that has so many different variables.
Once a farmer has at least started coming to a cover crop field day or meeting or asking other Practical Farmers of Iowa members for information about cover crops, once people have taken that step to at least be open to the idea, then we give them the beginner's guide, which would be fly on cereal rye into standing corn. So let's say 2015, I planted corn. Around Labor Day of 2015, I'm going to get my airplane ready to go, with contract that out, and I'm going to fly on cereal rye cover crop into standing corn, and then next year I'm going to plant soybeans. That's the easiest, probably best way to get started, because in the spring before soybeans, you have a lot more time to kill the cover crop, so it's bigger. So you've gotten more benefit out of it, and you're less anxious because you're just planting soybeans. It's a little bit more tolerant of being planted into that higher residue surface in the spring. So corn, rye, soybeans is probably the best way to get started. And then the other beginner's sort of advice that we hear is if you had soybeans planted in 2015, you could fly on spring wheat or oats. Either one of those, and they will winter kill. So then next spring when you go to plant corn, you'll just have this straw residue out there. You won't have a living green plant to deal with. And since farmers kind of get anxious in the spring to plant corn and they want to be the first ones out there, that green plant in the way can cause a lot of heartburn. So for somebody taking that first step after they've decided they're going to take a first step, which is a big hurdle, that first step is still a big hurdle, then the next step would be that beginner's guide. But after that, we see farmers, if they're successful, they sort of get the itch to try new things, and then the doors are wide open. Then we have lots of options because we can tweak the times when you plant corn and soybeans to incorporate different cover crops. We might work in a small grain so that we can try those sexier cover crops.
Ooh, what are they?
Well, like the oilseed radish is a really great cover crop, and farmers, you know, talk about it a lot. But the only way it's going to work again is if it's planted early in an open field. Crimson clover, that's another sexier cover crop. The vetches and red clover, those are good too. I'd say vetch does okay. Farmers like to try vetch, and sometimes it doesn't overwinter as well. So we want to try to make sure we get the seed that's the most winter hardy. But like the vetches and the clovers provide nitrogen, and so that could help you reduce your nitrogen expenses the next year for corn.
That's right. They're legumes.
They're legumes.
Nitrogen fixing.
Yes, but they need a lot of heat to really get their benefit. So sticking them into the window where they're only growing from, let's say, October to April is not enough time. So if we could shorten things up, take corn and soybeans out sooner, meaning we could plant in September, then we would have more heat units for that hairy vetch to really realize its potential.
So farmers might look at a short season variety of corn,
right,
one that doesn't take as long to mature.
Right, a shorter season corn hybrid or soybean variety, or they might choose to take those crops out wetter and put them on air, put them in the bin wetter, so that they're harvesting earlier. So the corn crop is physiologically mature basically around Labor Day, but then we leave it in the field so it dries down so that we don't spend the money on drying the crop. So if you could take it out earlier at a wetter percentage, then you just need to put it in the bin on air. So that would allow you to then plant that cover crop much earlier.
Those are great ideas. I think we're running out of time here on Tuning Into Agriculture, but Sarah Carlson, thank you so much for providing our first segment of this series.
Thanks for inviting me.
This is really interesting. Cover crops are something that we're finding farmers are passionate about. I'm on the PFI, Practical Farmers of Iowa, Cover Crops listserv, and the discussions are really amazing. This is what citizen science is. People are trying something, They share what they found. They discuss what might be other ways of doing it. They try it. And so it's this really collective learning and really builds a body of knowledge that is correct for where they are in Iowa. Agriculture is very context specific. So we can talk about cover crops in general, which are good everywhere. But what works where you are in Iowa varies a lot. So that's really important that people are exchanging things. The other thing that is really interesting is we can see this does some good for farmers. You can save on nitrogen. You can save on erosion. You can possibly keep from getting regulated if you do this right. But it's also good for all of us, which we acknowledge because we are giving payments from taxpayers' dollars from both the state and the federal government to get this practice on the ground. So I care about it because I am very concerned about the water we drink here in Iowa. We know we have to get nitrogen out of it. We know that it's not easy, but we know that everybody has to work on it. The other reason is when we have cover on the ground, particularly she talked a bit about water harvesting, but what you really do, what cover crops and no-till together can do is hold the snow. One of the worst places to drive in Iowa during any kind of storm is between Ames and Ankeny. That road has tons of accidents because there is so much snow blowing over the road. We could put in many more shelter belts, which we need to do, but by keeping material on the soil that is standing up, you capture the snow, it stops there, and then it will then turn into moisture for the soil, but it will also keep that snow from causing an accident on I-35. So there's some very sort of concrete ways all of us benefit when all of us help farmers do something that is both really exciting intellectually and serves the public good.
It's quite interesting to me that it's all kinds of farmers. It's the big farmers. It's the Farm Bureau as well as the small farmers and the organic farmers. It's every level.
I think this is what's really exciting about it. It does bring together a whole lot of people who might fight over some other issues, but this is a place everyone can work together. Now, you might do it differently depending on where you are on the ecological spectrum. And the more diverse your cover crops, we're learning, the more diverse your microbes and the healthier your soil.
That is truly something for everybody.
That's right.
This has been Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, Story City, Ames, and Surrounding Area. Your hosts for today have been Cornelia Flora and Susan Franzen, and our guests have been Neil Harrell, Susan Lazla, Del Christensen, and Sarah Carlson, who was interviewed by Porta Greta Anderson.
Thanks to special assistance from Paul Hertz for finding European folk music. The Farmer Went to a Fair from the Musica Bohemia, Czech folk songs, and A Farmer Came Riding from Weepers from the album Goral, Mountain Dwellers' Melodies and Songs from the Polish Beskid Mountains. This show was engineered by Richard Morrison. For the theme music for our new Tuning into Agriculture is the classic The Happy Farmer by Robert Schumann, played by John Zaradin and John Sands. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley.
Local Talk, like all KHOI programming, is now streaming live at khoifm.org. You can also listen to our programs from our webpage, where you'll be linked to the individuals and organizations mentioned on our show.
Local Talk is a radio production workshop as well as a radio show. You can join the team as a reporter by calling 515-292-2878 or at khoifm.org. Or stop in at our studio at the Pantorium, 410 Douglas Avenue in Ames.
Your support as a listener or as a contributor is what makes KHOI possible. Thanks for listening.
See you again on the radio.